How many times have our patients returned to our office and are just stuck in the cycle of chronic inflammation? We throw everything we have at them, nothing changes, and even our dentists are frustrated. Rather than throwing our hands up and shrugging, we need to be turning to PerioTrace by PerioProtect. I have seen the evidence firsthand and have helped so many hygienists find this resource because it really works, which is why there are so many products on the market now trying to imitate them. The results are speaking for themselves, but rather than going with an unproven product, stick with the only periodontal medicine delivery system cleared by the FDA. And not only that, but their support team is seriously among the best I've ever encountered, from the education to implementation to support when there's the inevitable bumps on the road. They are there for you. If you want to get in contact with them to learn more about how you can treat your patients better, head over to perioprotect.com/RDH. And on that site, at the bottom is a contact form that you can fill out or simply email them directly to ask for help. This is one thing I truly believe should be in every dental practice. perioprotect.com/RDH to stop the cycle of chronic inflammation.
I think there's a huge need for professional dental temp agencies. Now, if you're temping on your own, there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, you run into problems. Like, for example, if you hire somebody that you just know offers temp services, one, they could be misclassified like we're talking about right now. Two, what happens if they're injured on the job? Is the insurance going to pay for it? Is that, or would that be an out-of-pocket expense to the doctor? So there's so much room for liability. You want to be sure that people are trained properly. We sharpen our skills in office management and running businesses to be sure we're not violating any of the laws, which can happen without malice intent.
Get ready for your unofficial dental hygiene podcast. These are the tales of two hygienists, one East Coast RDH and one West Coast Guygenist. Listen as they tackle the profession of dental hygiene with humor and enthusiasm. Now, please join Michelle Strange and Andrew Johnston as they tell you a tale of two hygienists.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of A Tale of Two Hygienists. This is episode number 164. My name is Andrew.
And this is Michelle. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Michelle.
So this is going to be kind of a quick intro because we have something we want to share with you guys that we thought was really fun to receive from a listener. And we encourage anybody who has something to share that's cool and different about their way of practicing that maybe we would love to highlight that.
Yeah. I mean, and so we had an iTunes review from Lauren and we invited her to share her thoughts and her words. And rather than describing it to you, let's let you listen to it as well. So here it is.
Hi, Michelle and Andrew. It's Lauren, the hygienist who wrote you a podcast review on iTunes a few weeks ago. Thank you so much for giving me a little shout out on your show. I really look forward to it every week. It's like my favorite thing to listen to, especially on my way to work. So I wanted to get back to you and just send you just a file of me talking a little bit about some things that I think were helpful when I transitioned from being a hygienist among other hygienists in a private practice into a public health setting where I was the sole hygiene clinician. A little bit of background. I'm a PhD HP in Pennsylvania. I live in Philadelphia, and we have a form of independent practice in this state that mirrors a lot of other states, where we can provide hygiene services remotely without a doctor on site under certain conditions. So I do have a little bit of autonomy with my job, and I'm being utilized as a public health clinician for a small startup that helps people who are at risk for homelessness. So I transitioned from always having camaraderie with other hygienists in private work settings to being the sole clinician, and it was at first a little bit of a shock to my system. I think anyone, whether it's private practice, anyone who transitions to a smaller setting just needs to understand and believe in the fact that by default, when you become the only hygienist in your workplace, you're going to grow both as a clinician and as a professional. And it's important to really see this as an opportunity to be an advocate for the hygiene profession because you're going to be the one who educates and a lot of times builds awareness and value around what a hygienist can do. So keeping in mind that by default, you're going to be an advocate, and having that strong commitment to advocacy is what's going to help you succeed in this environment. Also having a little bit of patience, good communication, and flexibility. So I'll break that down. The patience element comes from, you know, being around other hygienists daily, being able to ask questions, having the camaraderie of talking about difficult cases, maintaining a sense of connection to other professionals, and kind of having that social aspect of being a hygienist built into your job already. Whereas when you go to a place where you are the only hygienist, you have to learn to be patient with clinicians who work in other aspects of dentistry, because a lot of times dental assistants, EFTAs, which is the Pennsylvania version of an assistant who can place restorations, and also a lot of times doctors don't really understand and know where you're coming from as a hygienist. I'll give an example. So I've been periocharting with our assistants at my work, and a lot of times it's a ton of education on what our assessments mean, what we're looking for, how we educate our patients. And this builds a lot of respect and allyship with the team that you're working with. Be it, you know, if you're the only hygienist in your office, if you go to a hygiene conference and you want to share new knowledge, you know, you're that person who's going to be calling a staff meeting, taking the time to share your findings, talking to people. So it's a lot of putting yourself out there and being willing to do so. And then I think that kind of ties into communication, where you have to implement a lot of humility in the sense that you need to understand that no idea or no clarification between coworkers is too minuscule. It's always better to be communicating a lot with your coworkers than not communicating at all, because that leads to, I think, a lot of times failure in situations like these where you're going to be the only one who understands sometimes, and that's okay, as long as you're trying to take your time getting there with other people. And the flexibility part is true of public health in both private practice. You know, your role as the only hygienist is going to morph and change a lot from what you're used to. And so that might entail, you know, grant writing, maintaining inventory. I would say absolutely, if you're the only hygienist, you want to have a strong hold on what your inventory is, what it needs to be, and really plan to bring evidence to the table to your employer on why you need the things you do need to get your job done. And that's okay. So just understanding too that you're going to need to be flexible in terms of what your job requirements actually are. So I've got about 6 months in at my current job. I'd say it's going well. And those are the things right off the top of my head that I can think of that have really lended to transitioning in a positive way versus feeling really burnt out or feeling like nobody understands me. You know, there is a lot of work that has to go into pursuing continuing education, networking, making sure that you maintain your ties to your fellow hygienists, because that is so important, especially we're in a time where things are changing really, really rapidly. And it's those conversations and that education and those relationships that are going to help you to stay current, but also work in an aspect of dentistry where maybe you are the only RDH at present. So I hope that was helpful. If you guys ever want to do like a roundtable discussion and get a little more in depth with this, I would love to. You know, I think, especially for me, I work in public health, and I see that as a very underutilized aspect of dental hygiene, where there aren't a lot of people who want to do it right away, but the rewards and the benefits of it and the way that it helps you grow, I mean, it's just mind blowing. And so thank you guys so much. Looking forward to your next show. Hope you both had a great weekend. Bye-bye.
So wasn't that nice? Super nice and amazing. So thank you, Lauren.
Loved it.
Really appreciate that. And like Michelle said a minute ago, if anyone wants to reach out and have their voice heard on the podcast, just send us a message at atelatohygienist@gmail.com.
Perfect. Look at you remembering our email and everything. Good job, Andrew. And this interview today is with Olivia Wan, and you have heard her on the podcast before. She's done a little quick thing on her Instagram before. She is like dental assistant turned lawyer. I mean, I love that transition so much. And then she's does consulting as well. And today she is going to talk to us about 1099s and why that ain't all right, y'all. Like, there's a problem with that. And she really kind of breaks it down for us. And we felt that this was an appropriate time because tax season is almost over, and she's going to give you some really great tips. So, and enjoy this episode with Olivia Wan.
Hey, Michelle.
Yeah.
It's time for the interview.
Oh, but I had something else to say.
We need to let the experts talk now.
Fine.
So we are always so excited to have guests come back on the podcast, especially when we love them as much as we love Olivia. And she was, I believe, episode 82. It was in the 80s. And we are very happy to have her back on because we have a common question and issue in the RDH world, and that is temping in dental practices and being paid 1099. So welcome, Olivia. Thank you so much for coming back on.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Of course. So tell us just a little bit about yourself again for those people who did not catch number 82, and I'm sure they'll go back and listen.
Well, I started in the dental field many years ago. I worked for a general dentist as a RDA and an office manager for 14 years. And then I went back to school. I earned my Bachelor of Science in Healthcare Management. And then I earned a law degree. So I've been consulting professionally 20 years and practicing law 7. I am licensed in Tennessee and Kentucky, and I do have to provide the disclaimer that this does not constitute legal advice.
Perfect, perfect. And that you are not a tax attorney as well.
That is correct.
Can we kind of start with what is the proper understanding of employee versus contractor designation?
I think there's a lot of confusion out there. This is a common support call that we receive in my office. And I know of several dentists that were actually audited because they were misclassifying hygienists as independent contractors, or sometimes it was related to paying them salary as exempt versus non-exempt. So I think it's important to evaluate how hygienists are being paid, whether a doctor is listening to this podcast or it's a hygienist. The IRS reminds small businesses how important it is to classify a worker in order for it to be accurately classified, that being an employee or a 1099 independent contractor.
I might have missed what you're saying. You're saying that some hygienists are salary employees, so you're exempt versus non-exempt. Is something also going on?
Yes, there's multiple issues. One is they're being classified as independent contractor, or they're being classified as exempt salary, meaning they would not get overtime.
I know. I'm like trying to process this too. I can see your face, Andrew.
I know. And I'm trying to wrap my brain around this. So,
because I worked salary and didn't get overtime.
Yeah. So let's say a hygienist is being paid salary.
Right.
And that's a fine, you know, they pay a set daily rate, but a hygienist does not meet the IRS standard of an exempt employee. That would be like a professional executive type level person. So the doctor can still pay a flat rate for a daily wage, but the hygienist would still maintain time records. And if the hygienist worked more than 40 hours a week, the hygienist would be paid time and a half. So we have to make sure we have the salary classification correct. So if you have an operations manager or business executive in your practice, or especially if there's multiple satellites, that person is likely paid as salary exempt, meaning they're paid an annual amount regardless how many hours they work.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a difference in the salary classification. So I do find some discrepancies there, and that has actually resulted in the Department of Labor auditing the doctor's records. And what happens in those cases, the hygienists are paid back wages for the overtime they weren't paid.
Interesting.
And this may not come up a lot because a lot of hygienists work less than 40 hours a week. But there are some practices out there where they would work more than 40 hours a week, and this would become an issue.
Well, it's funny that you said this, Olivia, because I was just thinking, I remember at my second job, I actually proposed that I wanted to work as a salaried employee because, one, I would make more money, but then I'd also be putting in more hours. And I'm just trying to think of, did I end up screwing my doctor over by proposing all of this stuff and didn't disclose all that? Because I didn't know that was a thing.
Well, you have to remember, there's two classifications. One is exempt and non-exempt. Non-exempt means that individual would be paid for overtime and they have to keep up time records. So if someone is salary exempt, they're typically management level people with the authority to hire and fire. So we have to get that part right, because like I said, that did result in a doctor being audited and the back pay had to be paid. And when the Department of Labor audits, they look through your records back 3 years. We need to be sure everything is correctly classified from that perspective. And then we move into the classification issue of 1099 versus employee status. So I think there's a lot of confusion out there. And the IRS provides a lot of helpful position statements and tests that you can evaluate to see what category that you're in. But I do see a lot of misclassification common in the dental industry.
I am struggling. This is why Andrew does our taxes.
Well, hold on. To be fair, everyone, I don't actually do the taxes. We have an accountant that I do all the numbers, though. I don't trust myself. Yeah. All the paperwork. I do all the collection for it. Okay. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can, okay, let's, after I've kind of taken this off in this weird tangent of salary exempt, non-exempt, all of this stuff, let's go back to the 1099, because I feel like that's the most important piece that we need to talk about. Because I feel like, how many times do we see it, Michelle, on the RDH forums? Mm-hmm. I got this. I was temping in an office and I got a 1099. They said I was W-2. They said this, they said that. And I feel like that's where we need to kind of stay focused.
Did we clearly define employee versus contractor?
Well, and I think that goes through the course of the discussion in determining which classification. And so that requires an evaluation of that person's work status. So I think it's a good idea to look at, well, what happens if it's misclassified? Because hygienists would say, well, what does it matter? You know, I'm paying that person for their time, paid for work, and they're being paid. But it's important to understand what happens if they're misclassified. So let's say that the hygienist is classified as 1099 and the Department of Labor audits the employer. Well, the employer, the doctor, would be liable for the employment taxes that was not paid on that hygienist.
Right.
And if you think about it, the hygienist would have been shorted on the taxes being matched. So when you're an employee, the employer matches the federal withholdings. So, you know, looking on down the road when you're collecting Social Security, that could be an important situation to think about.
Yeah, that's huge.
Social Security and Medicare, you have to pay in 40 quarters. That's about 10 years of service.
This is a hard subject for me to follow, if I'm being completely honest, Olivia. This is difficult. I don't know why it's so hard to wrap my brain around.
So let's say a hygienist, let's say I'm a dentist and I hire a hygienist to temp for 8 weeks because a hygienist is taking leave to have her baby.
Maternity leave, right. Mm-hmm.
We have to be sure that we're classifying that hygienist correctly. If they're a 1099, that means that they work for themselves. They're self-employed. We then have to look at the state board requirements. I'll use Tennessee as an example. In Tennessee, the hygienist is licensed to practice with direct or general supervision of the dentist, meaning the hygienist cannot set up his or her own practice in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. They're under the supervision of the dentist. Well, a 1099 independent contractor is not really supervised by the payer. They're independently working. Now, in other states where a hygienist might could set up their own practice, these rules would be interpreted differently. And I think that's what makes for so much confusion, because you really have to evaluate the situation according to state and federal rules. So So if the hygienist is being incorrectly classified as an independent contractor, that means that person was just paid a flat rate and taxes were not withheld. And the hygienist would have to pay the taxes for what they were paid. What is it? Anything over $600, you have to report it. So that means they're going to have to pay those taxes themselves. And there was no matching of the federal withholding, which takes place in the employee and employer relationship. So if there's a misclassification, then that doctor's responsible to pay those taxes in on that employee.
Can we talk like real numbers for just like a quick second? And maybe this isn't, maybe this is a part that we edit out later on, but okay. I'm trying to break down the actual numbers. So let's say that if it's $600 is what has to be reported. Mm-hmm. And let's say they paid that hygienist $1,000. I'm not really great at tax rates, but let's say it was 25%. Is it 25%? Is it about the federal withholding?
About 20. I mean, the employer matches what? About 7.5%, somewhere in that neighborhood.
So is that, and I guess that kind of goes to my question was, let's say that the total number of the federal withholdings is 25%. So that's $250, right? Of that $250, are you saying that the employer does 7% or does a percentage of that $250 so that the hygienist wouldn't have to pay that? Or is that in addition to the $250?
But I think it needs to make it a little bit more simpler is that if you're an employee, the employer is withholding out of your check the taxes that you have to pay regardless. So they're withholding that out of your check every pay period. Mm-hmm. And then the employer matches the federal withholding. When you're self-employed, you pay self-employment taxes because that federal component you're having to pay on your own. So it basically what results, the hygienist is going to end up paying more in taxes, making sure things are being classified correctly. Now, whether the doctor is audited or not, it may not even come up, but you want to be sure you're classified correctly in case the doctor is audited. There'll be a difference in tax. When you're self-employed, you're paying a higher rate.
You are paying a higher rate. Okay, that was my next question.
Federal. Because the employer would have matched it.
Would have matched. So there's not necessarily a tax break between, let's say that you're just completely self-employed. They wouldn't say, okay, now we're going to tax you because you're self-employed, don't have an employer. We'll just tax you at 20%. But if you're employed, then it's 25% because we know the employer's going to match. They don't do that. It's just a straight number of, hey, if you've made between $25,000 and $50,000 or $50,000 and $100,000 or whatever, you get taxed at a certain rate. Is that how that works?
That's really not what we were focusing on how much revenue they were generating or being paid as we were the employer matching the Social Security. Mm-hmm. So you're going to pay a higher, when you're self-employed, just like with myself, I'm self-employed, I pay a higher rate. I pay my federal withholdings. Whereas if I was still an employee, the employer would match what was withheld from my check for federal withholding purposes. Now, what I want to make clear beyond the tax issue is that if the hygienist is not classified correctly, both on a federal and state level, then that's an opportunity. If there's an audit, the back taxes would have to be paid by the employer. So that may not be a concern for the hygienist, but it's a concern, of course, for the doctors.
Why do you think that this was something that was ever even started?
What do you mean?
With the self, like paying as a 1099 contractor, was it to not pay?
It shorts the hygienist on taxes because they're not paying them and they're not matching them.
So the business owner was saying, hey, we're going to save money by not having to pay the matching.
Well, and it could be a paperwork problem if someone is not using a payroll service. It might be a little bit extra work. If you have somebody temping for just a few days, having to set up the tax tables and enter that person as an employee. But as I mentioned, it's very important to have them classified correctly. Otherwise, they're going to be responsible for those taxes. And that's why I tried to give the example to make a little more sense. If the doctor is hiring a contractor to paint the office, the contractor is truly a 1099. The contractor works for himself. He has his own paint. The brushes, the equipment, ladders, everything is provided by that contractor. Mm-hmm. But when a hygienist comes in and works for a dentist, they're not bringing in their own autoclave, their own instruments, all of their own personal protective equipment. That's being provided by the payer, which is the dentist. And so if we analyze these relationships, we would see most often than not that that hygienist would be more accurately classified as an employee and not a 1099. Now, I did say with the exception of some of those states where you might have self-employed hygienists because they're allowed to have practices independent of dentists.
And that would be more of like if the hygienist came in and maybe rented the space because then they would use all those that equipment?
Well, the example I like to look at in that instance is, let's say the dentist is employing an orthodontist and the orthodontist, the billing is going through the dentist for those services, but the orthodontist is serving patients and the orthodontist brings their own instruments, their own staff. And so the work is responsibility of the orthodontist. So that could be a 1099 relationship. This even gets confusing with associate dentist. You know, if the associate doctor is under the control of the employer, then that relationship may be properly classified as an employee rather than a 1099. So it gets very confusing, and that's why we look to the IRS to understand how to decide and classify a worker. So we look at behavior control. That's one aspect. So if the worker is an employee, then the business, or the doctor in this case, would have the right to direct and control the work performed by that hygienist. And that would involve instructions, instruments, supplies, services. And so with an independent contractor, they use their own methods, just like my painting example.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes it a little bit easier to follow.
Yeah, a little bit, actually. I think the understanding that it's not, I'm not bringing my scalers, I'm not bringing like ultrasonic bag or autoclave bags, all the necessities to treat and see patients, that makes sense. So essentially, if a doctor is not paying you as a W-2, that's pretty much illegal. Is that correct?
That's what results in misclassification and paying back taxes. So let's say a dentist is in that situation where they've incorrectly classified a hygienist as a 1099. There is an option to correct that, and that's where the employer would participate in completing this correction, and the Internal Revenue Service would assist them in getting that corrected without penalty. And I do have some links for that.
Ooh, that'd be great.
Yes, I could provide that for you following this podcast.
And if they're a W-2 employee, does that also allow them like workers' comp and all of that?
Yes. And that's a good point, because if you're a W-2, you have those protections of workers' compensation insurance, you know, making sure the tax is properly being withheld, and some of the other benefits. So even if it's a temporary employee, that needs to be in place. So getting back to the misclassified, that would be the Voluntary Classification Settlement Program. And so that would allow the dental office to reclassify the employee with a little bit of relief on those federal employment taxes.
What about unemployment?
Same thing. So if you're an employee, you would qualify for unemployment, whereas with a 1099, you would not, because you work for yourself.
So under the example that you gave us earlier, where let's say somebody was hired as a temp hygienist for somebody on maternity leave, and they signed up or they agreed upon 8 weeks, and let's say the hygienist comes back, she's like, I actually want to come back after 6 weeks because I'm out of, you know, for whatever reason. And the doc's like, okay, you can come back, and tells the temp hygienist, we don't need you these last 2 weeks. Could they file unemployment in that situation?
Yeah, even if they only work one day.
Wow. I feel like that's really kind of the underlying why they don't want to pay W-2 employees for all those little things.
And like I said, I get this question usually post the mistake. I'll get a panic email from a dental office that they're being audited. And usually that's the cult. It's one of two things. One, they were improperly classified as exempt salary and they didn't pay overtime. Or the other two being that they were improperly classified as a 1099 and they're subject to paying back the taxes. Now, let's say the hygienist is working for a temp agency. That would be a totally different dynamic.
Okay.
If the temp agency is employing the hygienist, then the hygienist would be an employee of the temp agency, not the doctor.
Would you encourage that at this point because there is so much confusion?
Yes.
Yeah. And do you have any suggestions on like what a hygienist can do? I mean, should they have... I mean, is pretty much going into the office and saying, no, I need to fill out a W-2 for you guys and just not working until you fill out that W-2 the right way to do it? Or is there something like a contract? Like you said, I will work for 8 weeks.
Well, for one thing, I think that rather than taking an adversarial stance with the employer would be, you know, doctor, I would like to make sure that I'm being classified correctly. So there's no problem if your records are audited that you're not subject to a tax liability. And if you take that approach, it may be a little bit easier to be sure this is handled correctly.
And are you getting pushback from dentists on this?
No, not when they know the ramifications and the consequences of what occurs. Sometimes I think that onboarding process is not handled properly. And it may be because there's a lack of training. And so when you hire someone, especially when you're in a rush, paperwork is not completed properly or the right paperwork, and you're trying to get people in place as soon as possible to serve the next patient. And so that onboarding process needs to be evaluated to make sure that we're handling it correctly.
You know, the pushback I hear on Facebook a lot is not so much from the dentist, but the office managers. And I wonder if this is just because they have to do the paperwork.
And I hope this doesn't sound like a push for one of my classes, but I have a brand new class I've been working on. Matter of fact, before I got to the office, I was finishing up. I've just put together a 3-hour HR course. And it's so needed. And it's geared for office managers and doctors to give them a little bit more training on how to evaluate situations like this and have more advanced application to understand worker classification, as well as the top 6 reasons that employees are improperly terminated. So I think that we sharpen our skills in office management and running businesses to be sure we're not violating any of the laws, which can happen without malice intent.
I think that's a great course.
Yes, very, very expensive claims. And so I think the 3 hours spent in class is well worth their time.
I'm wondering if the pushback on the profession from, because already now we hear people say, I can't take off work because, and this was in my office, they would not hire a temp. They just hated doing it. And I'm wondering if this would now be, well, if you take these days off, then I have to hire a temp and then I'm, you know, we have to do all these other little things and it kind of doesn't make it as easy. And now it's almost like you'll be shamed if you take off work. I hope that's not what happens, I see that being an issue. Agency.
I mean, my experience when I had critical opening for a paralegal, I used a temp agency so I would have more time to find one. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a bit more expensive on the hour. But it served a need, and I was able to fill a staffing opening right away, and someone that was qualified, and they had been screened and tested by the temp agency. So I think there's a huge need for professional dental temp agencies, and I know there's several groups out there that do provide that. Now, if you're temping on your own, that's nothing wrong with that, but you know, you run into problems. Like, for example, if you hire somebody that you just know offers temp services, one, they could be misclassified like we're talking about right now. Two, what happens if they're injured on the job? Is the insurance going to pay for it? Is that, or would that be an out-of-pocket expense to the doctor? So there's so much room for liability. You want to be sure that people are trained properly. So anytime we're doing government required training, such as OSHA or HIPAA, we ask that any of the temps that work with the practice participate in those training programs.
So what if, as people are going into tax season, what if they've been misclassified? What if they're all getting their tax documents and going to their tax prep or doing their own? God bless them if they're doing it themselves. But what if?
Well, they have to pay taxes on income earned anyway. So that tax is paid in. The doctor, wherever they work, that's where there's potential for liability, because with a misclassified employee, they didn't match the taxes on the federal. So, you know, that's one of the issues there.
So they should maybe call and let those offices know?
Yeah, I think that wherever they, because this program is being provided for all of the states and different places in the country, they need to have a serious conversation with the office manager, the practices payroll person, whether that's an internal person or an outside person, invite the input of a CPA. CPAs are very familiar with these IRS rules. Obviously, that's their area of expertise, and they can help them make sure that they're properly classified. So for year 2019, they would, you know, be properly classified, whether that's an hourly employee or 1099. And as I mentioned, I would lean to the fact that they're not a 1099. That 1099 is an independent contractor, and it involves the level of control that the payer has or does not have over that worker.
So is there a way for, is there anything that the IRS allows that the offices to use to reclassify their workers?
There are tools available to help classify a worker if they're not sure. They can access this at the irs.gov/businesses/small-.
Okay.
If that's helpful. And they can assist in making sure you're classified correctly. And there's a form SS-8, which is the determination of worker status for purposes of federal employment taxes and income tax withholding. And that can be completed to officially determine their status. And if they were incorrectly classified, then there are relief provisions for the employer. And that would be publication 1976, section 530, employment tax relief requirements. Mm-mm-mm. So it is a maze, and I wish it was more straightforward than what it is. And that's why I'm always reluctant to give my input on these social media forums. Because it's very muddy, and you have to take into consideration multiple factors, especially that this is involving the IRS.
So a good start from here on then would be just to allow, when you go in for those temping positions, instead of kind of being contentious about it, like, we just don't want you to get audited. So if we could just start off with these as a W-2 employee, here are the dates that you and I have discussed working, and go from there.
Yes. So I would approach it from the fact that you do not want the payer, which would be the employer, to be liable for additional taxes because they were not classified correctly. And so the takeaway is that hygienist is more than likely an employee, not a 1099. Because even with scheduling, who's controlling the scheduling? It's not the hygienist.
They're true.
Yeah, they're following the schedule that was made for them.
And do you suggest that hygienists get these kinds of things in writing, as far as if an office calls me and says, can you temp on from March 25th to the 29th, and we see patients from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m.? I mean, do you recommend getting that in writing? Because I could see also they say, like, oh, we just said Monday and Tuesday, and we only want you for the first part of the morning, or our patient's canceled in the afternoon, so we don't want you to come in.
Yes, I prefer, of course, everything in writing. So whether you call it a letter of understanding, a memo of understanding, I would shy away from a contract, because once you have a contract, you would be bound by it. So if it's six weeks, what if the hygienist didn't like the job? you know, they work one day and they think it's chaos and they don't want to come in the remainder of the period. So I would shy away from a contract in those temporary situations. That would not be the case if I was discussing a dentist. I would lean toward a professional contract. But I think there needs to be some kind of memo of understanding that documents the wages that they will be paid, their worker classification, what happens if there's cancellations. You know, I think it's very unfortunate where hygienists are being sent home. Well, I don't have a patient for the next 2 hours. You can just go home. Well, that person was engaged to work, and leaving early because there's an availability on the appointment schedule may not be in their control. And so are you being engaged to work 8 hours, 10 hours, 6 hours? What are those expectations that you have something in writing? And that prevents a lot of miscommunication, hurt feelings, and it makes it easier to work for that person again. And as a side note, I want to mention that I inspected a dental office some time ago and found a bunch of instrument packs that the chemical monitors did not change colors.
Mm.
And the hygienist said, well, we had a temp in last week. You know, that's critical. You know, if those instruments had been released to the patients, they were not sterilized, which was obvious with the chemical indicator. And so when we're hiring temps, you know, what level of training and guidance are we providing them on the systems that are currently in place? Because they may have come from a different dental office that had different procedures. So even issues like that, I say, would need to be addressed.
No, that sounds very smart. Because I can't imagine what the fines would be. And I also think that memo sounds nice also for the dentist. Because what if the hygienist is just like, yeah, this was the worst place in the world day one, and they just don't show up afterwards.
And let me make a little, give you a little example to maybe humanize this topic a little bit. A couple years ago, I had a dentist that was audited. And what happened, he incorrectly classified the hygienist as salary exempt. And so that means, all right, let's say they work 8 to 5. And on a daily basis, if they had finished their work at 4:30, they would just leave. But they were being paid a daily rate that reflected to 5 o'clock. On a few occasions, they had to work late because they weren't finished with their patients, so they worked past 5 o'clock. Now, granted, the days that they left early was not problematic, and they were happy, and they left, and they were still paid the entire wage for the day. But on the few occasions that they had to stay late, it became contentious.
Uh-huh.
And so a complaint was made, and when the Department of Labor evaluated their time cards, everybody was paid the overtime that was owed to them for 3 years.
Wow. So, 3 years.
Hurt feelings because he's like, well, I paid them for all the days that they left early, and I thought it was a wash for the days that they had to stay late, but that's not how it works. Those time records are important. You could call them legal documents. You have to maintain those time records on file. So if you're audited, they're going to make sure that you're in compliance with lunch and meal breaks and overtime issues. And so this is such an important area of management to make sure that our hygienists are classified correctly and they're being paid correctly. I mean, I've worked with some hygienists that they don't even get a lunch break because they're overbooked. And so we have to look at the state requirements. And I can give you only Tennessee as a comparison. So in the state of Tennessee, if you work 6 hours, you have to have a meal break, 30 minutes.
Only 30 minutes?
That's the minimum.
Okay. I was like, oh, man, what happened to the hour lunch break?
Yeah, hospital settings are different because, you know, you can't just leave a patient that's in a hospital bed to go take your break and then no one's attending to the patient. Different, but we want to make sure that people are getting their breaks in compliance with the law. And as I mentioned, states can be different depending. So it's very important to look up the requirements and see what they are before you're on the end of not being in compliance.
So are there any other little items that we might have missed in this whole independent contractor discussion?
Yeah. You know, a lot of hygienists do not carry their own malpractice insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that the hygienist is a 1099, which, like I said, I it's hard for me to see situations where they would be independent contractor. But if they were an independent contractor, they would have to provide their own malpractice insurance. Whereas if you're an employee, then the professional liability of the dentist is providing for any of the employee's mistakes, so to speak.
Yeah, I don't know many that do have malpractice.
It's expensive. So in my practice, if one of my employees makes a mistake, which means I made the mistake, let the master answer, my malpractice insurance provides that professional liability insurance. Now, if I had a 1099 and they're self-employed, well, they're, you know, that's a difference in liability. So really explore those relationships in making sure they're classified correctly, because there's multiple things that go wrong for that hygienist that they're not financially prepared for, whether it's tax issue or liability issue, or what if it was a breach, as I mentioned with the autoclave bags? What if there was a mistake that was made that compromised the safety of the patients because no one took the time to onboard that person properly?
So the onboarding of this, what if you... I mean, because we know you have to have like proper OSHA training for all your employees. And let's say you have a temp 6 times a year or even more frequently. So each one of those, I mean, should they be coming in like the day before, the week before, and get some kind of training in that office?
And well, you know, it may be they're doing online training, but we want to make sure it's site specific. So the law requires that we know where the work exposure control plan is, the hazard communication plan, where are the fire and emergency plans if there's 10 or more employees. So there's certain things that would need to be discussed if they're considered an employee. Now, we could make that as simplified as possible with the onboarding process, whether that integrates video with some oral instruction, making sure the right paperwork is signed off on. Now, let's say you're temping. Is there a confidentiality agreement in place to remind that hygienist that patient names and information is protected information of that dental office?
That's a good point too. So it would be smart of them to kind of have all of this stuff written up and recorded, maybe even have a video or some kind of training so that they could implement that when they need it.
And I've encouraged dentists to consider that, you know, we get so geared to policy and procedure, which is great. You have to have it. But why not create some simple short videos that people can watch and stop and go and still get the same benefit? You know, even for matters such as how you process instruments in that office, because every office could be a little different.
Right. Well, I think that's smart. Anyway, Andrew, have you ever temped?
Not really.
Yeah. I've only temped in a handful of offices, and it's very, the hygienists out there that are living that temp life, good for you, because you are obviously a person who can adapt well, whereas I am not someone that adapts well. I'm like, wait, where are the cotton rolls? Where's the section? Like, I don't know where all the little things are that make my day easier. If I am running behind, that just freaks me out and does not do well for my stress level. So I would love to know those things before I go in. And sometimes I don't have the time to have a day or an afternoon or an hour even to run into that office and go see the office.
Yeah, like let's say gloves. Let's create a small office and they don't have the right size glove for this temping hygienist. That could be a problem. The employer has to provide the personal protective equipment that's appropriate in the right sizes.
So I know this is a little bit of a digression from 1099, but if you go into an office and let's say you're doing ultrasonic techniques and they don't have the right size gloves, they don't have level 3 mask for you and the proper PPE. I mean, do you have the right to say, I can't work in this office today?
Well, I mean, that's the problem. I mean, the law requires that it's provided. And it does tie in 1099, because a 1099 would provide their own materials because they're self-employed. And if you're classified correctly as an employee, then the employer would provide the personal protective equipment in the right sizes.
So is there a percentage of equipment? So if I am a hygienist and I'm bringing like my scalers and I'm bringing my mask and my gloves and my loops, and all I really end up using is your autoclave, would that still put me as a 1099? Or is that if I'm still using any kind of equipment in your office to see your patients, then I'm an employee?
It gets back to classifying according to the categories of behavioral control. Mm. So is the dentist controlling how things are done? Not just the outcome. You know, their teeth are going to get clean. That's the outcome. But how is that process? And then financial control, and then relationship of the parties. And that's why I was suggesting you look at the Board of Dentistry's requirement. You know, if you're in a state like Tennessee, which is general, indirect supervision, meaning, you know, the dentist has to provide supervision, even if it's direct in general, then how is it that they could be self-employed?
Mm, okay.
I really would probe that relationship to make sure that they're in compliance with not only the IRS, but the state dental board requirement.
Well, this was very informative. Or anything else that we're missing?
I don't know. I mean, I think that it opens up.
Yeah.
Question, and I wish we could be very straightforward with the hygienists that are listening and doctors and so forth. But I think that what we do accomplish with this segment is they have to analyze that relationship and bring in their CPA's opinion, as well as the attorney that they work with, and make sure that management staff are adequately trained, that we're not just simply getting somebody's social security number and putting them there to work. Here's your patient. It's a little bit more involved than that.
So true. So if someone wants to maybe use your services or take some of your courses, where's the best way to do that? Or how's the best way?
Email. What's yeah, email way? Me at Olivia, O-L-I-V-I-A, at oliviawan.com. And as I mentioned, we're offering the Advanced Office Manager course at my office in Tennessee. It's one Friday per month. And you can check with my staff on those dates. We do a half a day of HR and we do a half a day of record keeping.
Nice. And what are some conferences that you're going to be speaking at?
I will be at Hinman next month in Atlanta. And I will be at the American Dental Association's annual meeting in San Francisco in September.
Very nice. And I really encourage you to go take some of her courses. I hope South Carolina brings you back here because you're one of my favorite speakers to listen to. HIPAA, OSHA, all of the stuff can be, I mean, kind of mind-numbing for some of us science nerds that don't process this information well, but you do a really great job at delivering it.
Thank you, Michelle and Andrew, for inviting me back.
Of course, of course. So be sure to check her out. And then your website is oliviawan.com, correct?
That's the law website, which will see
okay.
The page for both. And the dental site is dentalcompliancetn.com.
Perfect, perfect. Well, thank you so much for this information and coming back on.
Thank you as well.
All right. I'm so curious to see how many people have experienced that. So let us know. Send us a message. I've actually heard a lot of it in my area in Charleston lately. And so I can't wait to share this episode with the local group, Carolina Smiles. But we really appreciated her taking the time to come on and talk to us.
Yeah, that was really nice of her. And I think that that's such timely information and things that we see. Well, again, every time about this time this year, you know, every year.
Exactly. So if you have any questions, you're welcome to reach out to her, check out her website. She's a wonderful consultant. She has lots of great information. And if you have any questions for us, you can reach out at atale2hygienist@gmail.com. Head over to our website, atale2hygienist.com. Sign up for and subscribe to our future newsletters. And also find us on Facebook and Instagram. We love the interaction there. Like, share, share these episodes with friends, tag friends in the Facebook posts that we have, and let them know that there's some information if they are struggling with this topic. But we appreciate you guys listening for another week.
Thanks, everyone. I hope you have a good week.
Yeah. Bye, y'all.
Bye.